Our third and last speaker is Emeritus Professor Alan Atkinson, the author of many books, but best known perhaps for his multi-award-winning two-volume The Europeans in Australia, A History, published in 1997 and 2004. Alan is currently a senior tutor at St Paul's College, and he's writing a history of the college. And today he's going to talk to us about learning, piety, patriarchy, nostalgia, why men and women gave money to St Paul's College.
Thank you. St Paul's College was founded in the 1850s. From the beginning, its role and position were ambiguous. It was to be a college within the new University of Sydney, but also to exist in connection with, as the phrase used at the time, the Anglican Church. It was established with funds contributed partly by the colonial government and partly by private donation. The moment of its foundation was one in which, in political terms, an old land-owning elite was on the point of giving way to an energetic liberal democracy. And in a strong sense, the college was caught between the two. Again, the gold rush of the period supposedly created a culture of crass materialism in New South Wales and Victoria. And yet, the mass of new money also nourished large visions, not only of national greatness, each colony being an incipient nation, but also of moral, cultural, and intellectual improvement. The university itself had been planned from the late 1840s before the discoveries at Bathurst, near Bathurst. But it was reconceived on much larger and more splendid lines, thanks to gold, and underpinned by more elaborate ambitions. The college was also a direct product of a particularly fertile, contentious, and ambitious period for the Anglican Church, in Australia as elsewhere. For the next century, St Paul's sat somewhere close to the centre of plans to give the church a national dimension in the Antipodes, and to give the nation, whether New South Wales or Australia, a religious, even an ecclesiastical dimension. Plans, of course, harboured by a fairly small minority. The energy and range of these ambitions have never been comprehensively explored, but they moved significant numbers of men and women to give money to the college. The principal founder, Chief Justice Sir Alfred Stephen, spent considerable time on the bench scribbling pleading letters to friends and associates, and a total of £27,000 was raised in the 1850s to build or to begin building the college. A good number of benefactors were clergymen, whose generosity, given that they were not well paid, is testimony to the hopes held out for the college as a bulwark of Anglicanism. The bulk, however, were laymen prominent in the councils of the church. Some of these, including the very largest contributors, were clearly entranced with the idea of reshaping Anglicanism in the Antipodes, of giving it a deep Tractarian foundation in ways supposedly characteristic of a university college. They envisaged St Paul's as a home not just for Puseyite theology, for sacred art and sacred music, but also for related notions of the common and public good. The first warden, for instance, had come from England, where he's one of the founders of Christian socialism. Other subscribers were no doubt more concerned with ensuring that their sons could take advantage of Sydney University by living in a college of the Oxford-Cambridge type. However, superficially. Several in the Southern Highlands were men of large acres with offspring who did in fact come to St Paul's in due course. On the other hand, contributors from around Bathurst in the West included a good number who probably gave because they had more money than they knew what to do with, Bathurst being then the epicentre of the New South Wales gold rush. The gold rush, indeed, was fundamental to everyone's generosity, so that by 1859, with building only half complete, the boom ended and all donations ceased for the time being. During the rest of the 19th century, apart from a brief and successful campaign to build a home for the warden in 1885-86, there was no concerted effort to raise funds for the college. Some money came in for scholarships, but very little. At this point, wealthy Anglicans were relatively uninterested, less than Presbyterians and Roman Catholics, for instance, in making university education more accessible to the lower middle classes. The college was never deliberately exclusive, but on the other hand, it was never deliberately inclusive either. However, Anglicans did see a need to keep up the numbers of Anglican clergy and the influence of their church, if necessary, by recruiting young men of slender means. Of the scholarships and book prizes offered by the college at the turn of the century, nearly all were for work were for work done in divinity classes, typically taken by the warden, and for students intending to take holy orders. All this was bound to change as the college created its own numerous body of alumni, the great bulk of whom were laymen. From 1882, there had been a steady increase in the numbers of students entering each year, so that by the early years of the 20th century, there was a community of old Paulines, as they were called, with their own strong sense of the main virtues and purposes of the college. The St Paul's College Union, founded in 1891, taking up both past and present students, helped the process, adding directly, for instance, to the number of former students elected to the college's governing body. In 1910, a twice-yearly magazine, The Pauline, was started in an effort to keep the wider college community in touch with the achievements and the needs of its alma mater. It was hard to argue for more buildings while numbers of students were uncertain, but by 1908, the demand for places in college was clearly outstripping supply, and council now authorised the completion of the original plan at an estimated cost of £10,000. The first instalment, costing about £5,000, was to include the tower, 24 new student rooms, 8 bathrooms, 2 large lecture rooms and servant accommodation. The leading figure in the fundraising campaign was the barrister David Merriweather, who had been in college in the early 1890s and had only just been elected to council, a relative of Futurity Merriweather. It was Merriweather and men like him, former students now in their 30s and 40s, who set the tone of this campaign. Their ambitions were inward-looking, and they appealed not to sectarian or Christian idealism, but to college loyalties, to an entrenched sense of rivalry with other, newer colleges. Without more rooms, so their campaign leaflet said, many students would go elsewhere, to the present, and I quote, to the present and future detriment of St Paul's. St Andrew's College, already 50% bigger, was the main threat. The Rawson Cup, the great prize for intercollegiate sport, had been awarded for the first time in 1907, and, unsurprisingly, in view of their numbers, St Andrew's was to hold it for most of the next 4 decades. This was the sort of subtext for these campaigns. However, money was slow to come in. The alumni body was still small and relatively young, and many were men with growing families. After 6 years, at the start of World War I, only £800 had been collected, a fraction of what was needed. This effort was to set the pattern for the remainder of the 20th century. The leading theme was the college experience, powerful in memory but limited in reach. Besides alumni, the main donors were to be their near relations, fathers, sisters, widows, who knew that experience at second hand. The building effort was renewed in 1920. By this time, a new overall design had been adopted so as to accommodate nearly 200 students, the current number being 53. The campaign now concentrated on the increased size of the university's student population and the perceived need to be able to offer a room in college to every student who applied for one. In short, the organisers seemed to have believed that they had a responsibility to keep in step with the university as it responded to a 20th century national demographic, opening itself up to increasingly large numbers. But there was no hint of any larger idealism, of any need to make tertiary education more widely accessible. Certainly, the campaigners stated their regret, I quote, that numbers of Church of England men, through inability to pay the college fees, are compelled to forego the advantages of college life. This was a new argument, and it's one which seems to have made little impression. Once again, the response was disappointing, even before the 1930s depression intervened. Meanwhile, estimated costs rose sharply. By 1934, when ambitions had fallen back to accommodation for 90 to 95 students, the immediate target was put at £25,000, with £25,000 more needed for a chapel and library. In 1938, when a more skilled and concerted campaign began, the aim was £80,000. So, while alumni were multiplying and presumably getting richer as they got older, though the Depression had set many back, the sum asked of them was growing even more quickly. And yet the warden of the day, Arthur Garnsey, had very large intellectual ambitions for St Paul's, larger indeed than any of his predecessors since the 1850s. His deep involvement with the university, plus his broad church idealism, made him extravagantly hopeful about raising and spending money. The college, he said, should have funds sufficient, quote, to establish and maintain scholarships, lectureships, and a strong tutorial staff, and it should command the means to promote research, both extensive and intensive, in some of the many subjects of study proper to a university, as well as the systematic exposition and defence of the Christian faith, which alone could justify its existence as a church university college. With its Christian foundations thus strengthened, it would help, he said, to assert the dignity of theological learning and to leaven the life of the university with the wholesome influences of sound religion, by which he meant religion open to diversity of human experience and opinion. Ganzi was one of those who was behind the teaching of comparative religion at the university. Money-raising methods were more sophisticated than hitherto, but they had no connection whatever with Ganzi's idealism. Alumni were still the main and really the only hope, and campaigners appealed shamelessly to nostalgia and old fellowship. A number of former students volunteered to raise money among their contemporaries. Each man was to send out 25 form letters notifying his old friends of his intention to donate a small sum annually for 10 years on condition that 10 others would do the same. The method was mechanical and the tone artificially cheery, with references to, quote, to the extension of our dear old buildings where we had such a happy and hectic time, goodness knows how many years ago. What a pity, quote, that anyone should have to be turned away and so miss the good times we had at college. Alumni might well have been struck by the falsity of this approach. Certainly one munificent alumnus, Mr. Frank Albert, a musical entrepreneur, gave £500 and promised the same again if 10 others did likewise, which they didn't. But otherwise, donations were not only small, but also scanty. Besides, they were soon cut short by World War II. So every time momentum gets up, a world event intervenes. Yet another effort was made in 1947, but it was short-lived and dominated by a single large benefactor, the newspaper proprietor Sir Hugh Denison, whose three sons had been to Paul's. Only in the 1950s do we see the beginning of a skilled and concerted campaign to raise money from the now considerable number of college alumni. A hesitant start having been made in 1952, 2 years later, the accountant W.J. Southey Wilson took charge. It had always been standard practice to take donations by instalments. But Wilson had a flair for the business. As he explained afterwards, the sums coming in were mostly small, between £4 and £40, sorry, $4 and $40, because it would change by this time, though a few were as much as $2,000. But within 2 years, he raised $8,050, with about 250 subscribers sending contributions more or less regularly. The final total, raised between 1955 and 1963, was $43,400, which, with government help, allowed for the extension of college numbers by 40% and the building of a very fine chapel. Wilson put his success down to two things. He was himself a Pauline, and therefore trusted by his fellows. But on the other hand, he never made personal requests. Everything was done by generalised correspondence, in direct contrast with the equally successful methods of the founder, Sir Alfred Stephen, 100 years earlier. He did so well that in the end the donors didn't want to stop. "They strongly urged me," he said, "to organise another appeal for some other college project." This story, taken as a whole, suggests two things. Note the way in which, over the long term, the college changed in the minds of benefactors from a public cause to a private one, from an institution of public significance to one which mattered mainly for what it had done for each person, each ex-student, at a crucial period in their own lives. And yet, on the other hand, the most effective methods of fundraising among large numbers of the moderately wealthy shifted from the personal and direct, soliciting by private letter or even face-to-face, to something more detached and generalised. Gone were the published lists of donors in the Sydney Morning Herald, with precise sums against each name. Now it might be even hard to tell who gave and who didn't. In campaigns of this kind, giving had become a test of feeling, and the degree of feeling was to some extent a private matter. This is consistent with what Richard Sennett has called the fall of public man. A university college, as a semi-public institution, could no longer be witness to religious attachment. as St Paul's was designed at first to be. Money, once a means of demonstrating public virtue and public rank, was now more often a means of expressing feeling and reinforcing intimacy. In the end, St Paul's College benefited from being a place of intense feeling. Within its own circle, it evoked deep loyalties. Almost as a result, its public profile, insofar as it had one, didn't attract money from distant admirers. For the time being, at least, it apparently had few distant admirers, unless some money jewed the obscure, and it was obliged to make the best of its familiar friends.